Greetings and welcome to Understanding Israel Palestine Beyond the Walls on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. I am this week's producer, Jeremy Rothkuschel, with additional contributions from Margot Patterson. On this week's program, I asked Tahir Saidani, pen-named Palestinian intellectual from the West Bank, who works with liberatory conversation startup Al Muftakh, whether 100 years of the Palestinian response to Zionism might hold the key to further understanding Israel-Palestine beyond the walls. But first, the headline news.
Violence broke out in Jerusalem last week after Israeli police erected barriers at a site Palestinians had long been used to gathering at during Ramadan. Hundreds of Palestinians clashed with police close to the Damascus Gate to the Old City over what they regarded as unfair restrictions, with 21 people later rushed to the hospital for treatment for their injuries. 20 police officers were wounded in clashes with Palestinians and with extremist Jews who marched to the Damascus Gate after midnight shouting "Death to Arabs" and allegedly seeking to set fire to a home in the Old City. The turmoil in Jerusalem spread to other parts in the occupied territories. Militants in Gaza fired rockets at southern Israel, and the Israeli government launched airstrikes on sites controlled by Hamas in Gaza and barred fishermen in Gaza from fishing off the coast. Tensions eased this week with the police removing the barriers at what is the last gate to the walled Old City that is still very Palestinian in character.
Human Rights Watch issued a report this week accusing the Israeli government of committing the crimes of apartheid and persecution against Palestinians. The U.S.-based rights group says the term apartheid has generally been used as a warning of what could happen if current trends in Israel continue. After decades of warning, the 213-page report says that threshold has already been passed. According to the report, quote, "The Israeli government has demonstrated an intent to maintain the domination of Jewish Israelis over Palestinians across Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories. That intent has been coupled with systematic oppression of Palestinians and inhumane acts committed against them. When these three elements occur together, they amount to the crime of apartheid," unquote, it concludes. Israel's Ministry of Foreign Affairs called the charges in the report, quote, "preposterous and false," unquote. Human Rights Watch said its report was intended to compare Israeli law and government policy against legal standards governing the crimes of apartheid and persecution. The release of the report comes 3 months after a similar publication by the Israeli human rights organization B'Tselem, which also accused Israel of becoming a, quote, "apartheid regime," unquote. This is Jeremy Rothkuschel with Understanding Israel-Palestine, Beyond the Walls. I'm very pleased today to be joined by Tahir Saidani, the pen name of a Palestinian intellectual from the West Bank who works with Al Muftakh, the key. Al Muftakh is a burgeoning conversational and online media endeavor convened by a dynamic and diverse group of Palestinians who hold conversations on social media fora like Clubhouse and beyond about all things Palestinian, from discussions of history, folklore, and culture to assessments of contemporary political events and deliberations of rhetorical and political strategy, all framed by the concept of liberation aimed towards the practical realities on the ground, now and for the future. Thank you so much for joining us today, Tahir.
Pleasure to be with you, Jeremy.
This group, Al Muftakh, it's spelled A-L-M-U-F-T-A, parentheses 7, the key. What does that mean?
Yeah, so any youth from an Arab-speaking state would recognize Arabizi, which is sort of like IM speak. Basically, in Arabic, we have a lot of letters that you can't say in English or write. There's no letter for it in the alphabet. And so the kha is a 5, the 7 is a ha, etc. And so there are a number of different letters for different Arabic sounds that aren't in the English alphabet. And in this case, the word al-muftah means the key, referencing the key of the right of return. So the idea is that Palestinians who were expelled from their homes in 48 and 67, many of them held on to the keys to their homes in the hope that one day they could return. In some cases, even passed them on from generation to generation. And so the keys became the symbol of the right of return and the dream of one day returning home. Amongst Palestinian refugees, for a number of generations, this became almost like an heirloom. In some cases, people don't actually have the original key and the key is just symbolic. But in a lot of cases, people still have the key from their grandfather to their homes. And a lot of the people who were expelled from these villages in 48 and 67 during the ethnic cleansing that occurred literally made their beds that morning expecting to return home. So that's the idea.
Wow. There's so much resonance there in the combination of the bridging into the contemporary youth and digital culture and making one's identity and language work, even if it doesn't, there's challenges to it being expressed, and then the key as holding forth through the generations the desire and insistence to reclaim one's rights, one's birthrights, while also understanding it practically in terms of unlocking a difficult situation. So I appreciate you explaining that. And we are hoping to maybe bite off more than we can chew in our 20 minutes of discussion here, but let's get to it. The hope is that in the midst of what is going on contemporaneously right now, in the midst of Ramadan and the escalation of what look like pogroms from aspects of Israeli settlers in occupied Jerusalem, responses from Palestinians in Gaza, the IDF involved, we want to understand this moment by casting back over more than a century, really, in terms of what I might call, what I'm learning from you, that I understand as a long-term Palestinian consensus in relationship to the Palestinian response to Zionism from then to now. So will you take us back and help us understand what the Palestinian response to Zionism has been over the long term?
This is something that I care deeply about, in that I do think the Palestinian narrative is so misunderstood, particularly in more recent years. I think we spoke with a clearer and more unified voice prior to the Oslo Accords. But in the wake of the two-state solution, the Oslo agreements, there was a politicization, the tension between political parties, the infighting, etc. And then it turned into what the world understands the Palestinian narrative as today through the lens of international law and everything that's transpired since the 90s, you could say. But the narrative, particularly in relation to the response to Zionism, is much older. And people, when they think of what they call the conflict, quote-unquote, or Sira, as we say in Arabic, start their history from something like 48. When the history, I think, is easier to understand if you go a lot further back, to even taking a bit of a dive into Jewish history in the 18th, 19th century and the response to the first Aliyah and, you know, Herzl and the WZO on the Palestinian side long before 48, long before the war. And so if you cast your lens back to the 18th century in Europe, in the wake of the Haskalah, the Jewish Enlightenment, and legal equality being granted to Jewish citizens in France in the 1790s, an increased secularism within the society, followed by a rapid and extraordinarily intense rise in anti-Semitism in Europe. It was always present. It has a very, very old history, as far back as the Roman Empire, but very strong movement that arose, particularly in the wake of European ethno-nationalism. And so things got extraordinarily bad. Movements that spoke about a desire to assimilate as a way to keep the Jewish people safe, had their pushback. And so people like Herzl emerge in the wake of the Dreyfus Affair. And this ideology of what we can call modern Zionism is born. And very early on, and this is during the Ottoman era of Palestine, the mayor of Jerusalem at the time, Yusuf al-Khaldi, writes a letter to Herzl. This is in the late 1800s, effectively imploring him to go elsewhere. There were a people here. They were not going to accept the establishment of an ethno-national Jewish movement in Palestine. They were not going to accept partition, etc. And effectively imploring him to go elsewhere. And he even mentions the existing Jewish population in the Ottoman Empire, the impact it would have on them. And Herzl responds with something to the effect of, there is no desire to displace you. This will only bring benefits to the local population. And if needed, we will. Of course, that's not what transpires. This cycle continues into the first Aliyah onwards. And so you see a shift in how Palestinians respond to this movement in a parallel way to that timeline. So the timeline of the emergence of modern Zionism in Jewish society, Palestinian society itself was growing its own nationalist movement, sort of along a similar timeline. The best way to describe the land is effectively you have a number of tribes, clans, and farmers, fellahin, we say, in different regions, and they have a very strong regional identity. And so the Abdelahadis, the Tuqans, the Husseinis, the Nashashba, all these famous Mutasalim or Ayyan tribes and clans who are basically something like lords or tax collectors, these sheikhs would rule over these different tribes, protect the local farming population, pseudo-feudal system, with a very strong regional identity. So each tribe had its land. There's a diwan, which is like a meeting place for that tribe, or a majlis, like a meeting council. And the land is broken up into these different tribes that at various points rebel and achieve autonomy, you know, independent kingdoms of sorts, or independent sheikhdoms, you'd call them, like that of my pen name, you know, Zahar al-Umar al-Zaidani. In the wake of the fall of the Ottoman Empire, you then see a very rapid rise in Arab nationalism across the Middle East in general. And interestingly, the response to the Zionist movement on the Palestinian side in the early 1900s was relative ambivalence. So you have the first Aliyah where a number of Yemenite and the later Eastern European Jews arrive in Palestine and are met with total ambivalence. The local population really doesn't have an opinion here, partially because this has happened before. You know, we've had mass migration of ethnic groups like the Armenians to Palestine, live there and integrate into the community. And worth noting, without assimilation, so they had their quarters and their culture, their vibe, and they fit quite nicely into the society, which is already, in a way, a mosaic of tribes. And there are Aramaic-speaking tribes, Christian tribes, Muslim tribes, etc., Druze. And so the land is already a number of different cultures, and particularly immigrant groups who come with these cultures bring opportunities for local traders, etc. And people don't really particularly expect them to assimilate. They, over a number of generations, just become part of the society. These quarters are well known, the Armenian quarter, a particular city, etc. So the reaction was relative ambivalence. And that starts to shift very quickly. And so you have Palestine and Al-Karmil newspaper. Palestine is the Arabic pronunciation of Palestine. So you have these newspapers that begin to write about Zionism to explain what is occurring here, very much quoting the words of Herzl and Max Nordau and Hart Ha'am and Jabotinsky and all of these figures who are bringing this ideology and explaining it to the local population, particularly the political ruling class, these clans and families. And that is probably where the population's reaction to the movement shifts from ambivalence to hostility. Palestinians are fundamentally opposed to this national project, albeit the hostility remains tame until about 1917 with the Balfour Declaration, where things get a lot worse very fast. Balfour was seen as a vindication of everything that Isa al-Isa was saying. He was the editor of a Palestine newspaper. A vindication of everything he was saying in this paper as to the aims of this immigrant group, the recognition of them not as immigrants, but actually as a settler colonial movement. They certainly refer to themselves as such, Jewish colonial office and whatnot. And therein begins a rapid increase in hostility. At the time of Isa Elisa, it was still under Ottoman rule, and he actually had to speak before a court, which suspended his newspaper on a number of occasions with the fear that it would incite hostility or violence inside of Ottoman-era Palestine. And his defense in court was basically something to the effect of, Palestinians do not oppose Jewish immigration to the land, they oppose the establishment of an ethno-national state there, a homeland exclusively for the Jewish people, given that the vast majority of the local population was not Jewish. And he said as much in court. He specified that his opposition was to what he called the Zionist Party, because he saw them as a political party, like a hezeb, you know, we say in Arabic. So his opposition to this political party, not to Jewish immigration, and was able to fall within the guidelines, I guess, of the Ottoman court and continue writing. Things continued to escalate, the number of aliyahs onwards. Balfour, the hostility is palpable.
You're listening to Understanding Israel, Palestine, Beyond the Walls on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. I am Jeremy Roth-Kushel, and this is an interview with Thahir Zaidani, a Palestinian intellectual from the West Bank, who works with the liberatory Palestinian discussion and social media group Al-Muftah, The Key, about the deeper history of the Palestinian response to Zionism, and whether contemporary voicing of this Palestinian response might give power to its long, consistent call for a unity of the land of Palestine for all the people on the land, and whether ultimately necessary to successfully liberate the rights of the Palestinian peoples themselves. In this interview, Thahir has referred to aliyahs. Aliyah, meaning going up, is a Hebrew word for the religious ritual in Judaism of being called up to the pulpit to read segments of Torah. The word has also been used to refer to the return of Jews to the biblical land of Israel. During the era of political Zionism, Aliyah has referred to subsequent numbered waves of Jewish immigration to Ottoman Palestine from the first Aliyah during the early 1880s onwards to British Palestine through the fifth Aliyah from 1929 to 1939. Aliyah as a concept continues to be the basis for the Israeli state policy that grants Jews from all around the world the quote-unquote right of return to the state of Israel. Now back to the interview with Thahir Zaidani.
Things continued to escalate, the number of aliyahs onwards. Balfour, the hostility is palpable. It eventually resulting in Thawrat al-Buraq, the Hebron massacre in the 1920s. Intercommunal conflict then in Mandatory Palestine was at an all-time high. You basically have a local population that identifies this movement now as a colonial one in all of its tactics, its behavior, its strategy and attitude towards the local population, particularly the calls for transfer. And that is a lot of what starts being published in these newspapers, taking words directly from the mouths of these leaders, the calls for the transfer of the local population, the compulsory transfer, which is effectively a euphemism for ethnic cleansing. And also the referring to the local population a number of times as the equivalent of redskins. Those were the words that they used. So comparing them to, you know, native populations in the United States and saying they are rocks that must be cleared on the way to Judea, etc. The conflict, you know, is burgeoning at this point. By the 30s, sort of after the Peel proposal, negotiations starting to occur. This is now under British Mandatory Palestine. So you see negotiations start to occur, and right from the start, I think the Palestinian consensus, let's call it, is fairly clear. We are opposed to partition because we are not one tribe. We are from all over the land. Akkawi, there's a number of different families, and that's where they come from. The Tuqans in Nablus, the Abdul Hadis in Jenin, the Husseinis in Jerusalem, all these different clans and tribes come from particular places in the land. That's almost their entire identity, their music, their dress, their food, their dialect, the homes that their grandfathers built generations upon generations are very specifically tied to these locations. So partition was an idea that people would not accept under any sort of circumstances. The response that the AHC basically gives to the Jewish agency is something to the effect of a binational state. We refuse to partition the land, so if you're going to live here, you're going to have to live here with us under one democratic state from the river to the sea. And I think that theme then continues onwards throughout the conflict, particularly around the unity of the land. And then after 48, with the Nakba, it shifts to a unity of the land as well as right of return of the refugees who were expelled from their lands.
Will you take us through, in our last segment here, this post-Nakba, post-foundation of the Israeli state, through to our contemporary moment by touching on the question of where the key may actually lie in terms of al-Muftah, and begin to help us understand what the power of the Palestinian consensus in the contemporary moment might be?
Effectively, after 48 and 67, where the ethnic cleansing of these villages occurs, 800,000 Palestinians are forcibly expelled from their homes. There are massacres, lootings. The Palestinian consensus is, regardless of what our leaders and politicians say, it's in opposition to modern Zionism's fundamental tenet, this demographic war that was waged from the beginning of the conflict. The need for ethnic cleansing came from this ideology, this idea that Jewish safety can only occur by establishing an overwhelming majority in this area, and that basically the presence of Palestinians in their native homeland is a threat to their safety. That is how it was posed to the local population. That demographic war has then continued ever since. We see this today in Jerusalem with areas like Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan, where people are forcibly expelled from their homes still in order to wage that demographic war. And it's never been subtle. These politicians were fairly comfortable in saying that the Palestinian population represents a demographic threat. Netanyahu referred to them as a demographic bomb. This ideology of the premise of the state must be ethno-nationally or ethno-religiously, you could say, Jewish in order for this democracy to be safe for a portion of the population. It's a parallel to me to many other settler colonial projects, including apartheid South Africa. The Bantustans then, another form of partition, were not going to be accepted by the local population. I think the future of Palestinian liberation is to communicate this idea fairly clearly. Partition has never had a mandate from the Palestinian people. There's always been a sort of Palestinian consensus regarding the unity of the land, simply because 60% of the population of Gaza isn't from Gaza, and a third of the population of the West Bank isn't from the West Bank. Indeed, the portion of the population that supports the idea of partition is roughly the same as the portion of the population from these areas. And the two-state solution, the Oslo Accords, I think, have always played the role of trying to cloud this concept for the cause to not be seen as parallel to the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, where there are a lot of parallels, both ideologically and in terms of the geographic, demographic war, the pushing of Palestinians into Gaza and the West Bank, Area A, B, C, etc. And so I think this idea is what needs to be communicated clearly when Palestinian liberation and the ideological conflict that has always been present between the local population and the Zionist movement is fundamentally about equality, about a rejection of an ethno-religious state that excludes half the local population, and historically the overwhelming majority of the local population present there at the time. Communicating this narrative where our leadership will not, and where the acceptable mainstream political discourse is so focused on a solution that is neither practically viable nor has a mandate from the Palestinian population, I think is very important and is what we are all about.
And I think this combination of the clarity in relationship to the Zionist project of the ethno-state, which was disclosed, as I've talked about before here, by Caroline Glick at a conference a few years ago when she gave a Freudian slip. She meant to talk about the Jewish democratic state, And she said the Jewish demographic state, which basically exposes the project, I think, very, very clearly. And then what you are bringing to this, it seems like, is that there's also an apparent opaqueness to what is really maybe the Palestinian organic voice. No matter which tactics politically, either leadership or the streets may take, whether it's two-state solutions, intifada, boycott, divestment, sanction, that the concept of the unity of the land and the rights of the Palestinian people is really what should be put forth front and center. So any final comments, and will you let us know where we can find Al-Muftakh Fakhir Saidani?
In a nutshell, when Palestinians say the phrase from the river to the sea, in a Nahr al-Bahr, there is an attempt to, make that out as a call for genocide, when it is a call for equality. Apartheid South Africa fell. It was by putting aside this notion of partition, which was not an acceptable solution for the population who was there at the time. Democracy, equality, the right of native people to return to their homes. That is the crux of what Palestinian liberation means for us. It is fundamentally the rejection of ethnic discrimination. That is at the heart, I think, of this future state, the opposite of everything that Israel stands for today. You can find videos, YouTube content, or editorials on almuftah.org. That's almufta7.org. And otherwise, it's been a pleasure speaking to you, Jeremy.
Thank you so much, Fakhir. This is Jeremy Roth-Kushel with Understanding Israel-Palestine Beyond the Walls. I've been speaking with Fakhir Saidani, the pen name of a Palestinian intellectual from the West Bank who works with Al-Muftakh. You've been listening to Understanding Israel-Palestine Beyond the Walls on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.